Hi, you're watching DNA Today, a multi-award-winning genetics podcast where we explore everything to do with genetics, from CRISPR to rare diseases to new research. We have won the Science in Medicine Podcast Award for many years now. We have hundreds of episodes, and we really hope you enjoy these conversations where we dive into so many genetic concepts. I'm Kira Dineen, a certified genetic counselor and your host. We're exploring Duchenne muscular dystrophy in this episode. Joining me for this conversation is Dr. John Day, the director of the Neuromuscular Medicine Division at Stanford University. Carly Siskind is the board certified genetic counselor currently working with Dr. Day at Stanford, and wanted to make a note before we jump into the episode that this is kind of a first part of the conversation where we're focused on the background of DMD and exons. In the near future, we're going to continue our DMD conversation by diving into gene therapy, including the new FDA-approved drug, which is very exciting in our field. But thank you both so much, Carly and Dr. Day, for coming on. I'm very much looking forward to this because definitely the second part of our conversation, I actually don't know a lot of these answers. So that's always an exciting part for me. So thank you both so much for taking the time to come on DNA Today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I thought we would start with just a little bit of background on DMD, as I prefaced. So Duchenne muscular dystrophy, we'll probably refer to it mostly as DMD today, is a progressive degenerative disorder that results in the loss of ability to walk in early stage and sadly is fatal. So Dr. Day, maybe you could start us out with telling us a little bit more about this disease and expand upon that just very, very quick blurb.
Sure. It's the most common form of muscular dystrophy, as you pointed out, and affects about one in every 3,500 boys. It was identified about 150 years ago. We've known about it for quite a while, and so studied it in terms of its clinical features for many years, but found the gene responsible for it in 1986, and so have been gradually learning more about the genetics and only recently beginning to actually be able to control the genetics and hopefully slow the course of the disease and ultimately stop it.
So what exactly causes DMD then? I know you mentioned the gene and discovery of the gene, which, I mean, hearing that year, like, you know, mid-80s, like, that's pretty early on in genetics and finding genes. It wasn't the first gene, but pretty early on. But how did we kind of learn about this? Like, how do we know, like, what causes DMD and DMD in terms of that gene?
In ways, it was the first gene. It was really of the first, if not the first gene, identified by positional cloning. So it really was located on the X chromosome because it had been defined as being an X-linked disorder for many years. And slowly, the region of the X chromosome that was involved was identified, and then the gene became evident. It's a novel gene. It's the largest gene in the entire genome. It's not the largest protein that's encoded. There are other proteins that are larger, but this is the largest gene, and it is a very substantive protein. So missing it is really quite detrimental to the muscle function, and it causes deterioration of the muscle, leading to the loss of muscle strength and ultimately to the death of the boys that are affected.
And that makes sense when, you know, mentioning that this disease presents early on in life, like between 3 and 5 years old, typically for boys. And so that makes sense because it's such a large gene, like the impact of that and the fact that it's on the X chromosome. We knew with it being X-linked of affecting people assigned male at birth more than female that, okay, we can kind of narrow it down to be like, this is probably on the X chromosome, which I imagine led to it being discovered earlier than other genes of like actually locating it. All those factors playing a role. I'm kind of like, as you're saying that, I'm like, oh, it's all piecing together for me. So one thing that I remember learning in grad school was you have the DMD gene and mutations in this gene can cause Duchenne, as we've been talking about, but also another condition called Becker. How is that? How can mutations in the same gene cause two similar disorders, but, you know, different disorders? Carly, I'd love to hear from you just in terms of having the genetic counselor background of kind of from genetic counselor, explaining that to our audience.
I think we have to start by talking about exons if we're going to have that conversation, or Maybe we also need to define a little bit about Duchenne versus Becker. So you want me to start there?
Yeah, that's perfect.
All right. So we, at this point, I think, are still using the definition of loss of ambulation at 12 years of age or earlier as being defining Duchenne. And Becker's, in general, is 16 years of age of loss of ambulation or later. So there is also that middle piece there then between 12 and 16, which can be sometimes referred to as an intermediate muscular dystrophy. But the 16 years or later is also kind of a challenging group because you can have these men who are 70 years old who walk into a clinic who have a little bit of weakness, and it's like, do they have the same thing as a 16-year-old who's in a wheelchair? So some of these people, instead of getting a Becker diagnosis, may have something that's a little bit more generic, like a dystrophinopathy. That's also discounting all of the women, and maybe we'll have another time to talk about that, but that's kind of the categories. And your question originally, Kara, was about how could there be these different phenotypes? And again, that comes back to the exons for the majority, or how much protein is being made. The amount of protein that's being made, how much dystrophin protein being made, ends up being the idea of, like, there's not a lot of protein being made or zero protein being made, then someone's going to develop Duchenne. Versus if there's some protein that's being made, then you're going to potentially have a Becker's phenotype. The exons compared to the introns is, you and most of your listeners probably know, the exons are essentially the part of the gene that codes for proteins, and the introns are the stuff in between. And when we learn about exons in general, we usually just think of them as like chunks, and they all come together and they fit a protein. And very uncommonly do we think about how those chunks are actually arranged on the gene itself. And maybe this is a good time to pull up our exon map.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
You know, for those of us who were seeing patients before the gene was discovered, we didn't know if Becker and Duchenne were even related. You know, I mean, Becker was one of the forms of limb-girdle muscular dystrophy, and we weren't really sure. I mean, it was clear from some families that it was X-linked, so it was there was the possibility of it being, you know, an allelic disorder, if you would, with Duchenne. But that wasn't obvious from the get-go. So the name precedes the genetic diagnosis.
Interesting. I don't think I really fully understood that. And
yeah, neither.
It is different in terms of, you know, Dr. Day, with your more historical perspective there of looking at
historical. Yes, that's the term.
That was the politically correct way to say that. But yeah, you bring a lot of experience onto this. And
well, there are other forms of muscular dystrophy. There were several. I mean, you know, there was quadriceps dystrophy was another recognized, presumably X-linked form of muscular dystrophy. That ends up just being a form of dystrophinopathy. That's completely gone by the wayside now.
Wow.
But, we just didn't know what was related.
So once we like understood a lot of the genetic causes to these diseases, we're like, oh, now we can recategorize and understand. So that must have been a huge shift in
you've seen it
80s,
in every
90s.
Other disease, right?
Yeah, right.
Every disease is, when you're making a phenotypic classification, you end up doing things very differently than when you're making a genotypic classification.
Yeah, so there is that differentiation between them.
You know, there are three different ways of classifying Becker. You know, you can do it clinically. Do they continue to walk past the age of whatever you choose, you know, 12 or 13, you know, so Duchenne, they stop before then. You can do it genetically. Do they have an in-frame or out-of-frame mutation? Or you can do it on biopsy, you know, where they do they have protein or no protein? And, you know, you'd like to think that those three line up, but they don't, you know, so that you can have a genotypic Becker that is a phenotypic Duchenne in terms of their their functional state, or vice versa, you know. So it's noisy. It's not a clean classification, no matter how you do it.
So that makes both Dr. Day and Carly, your jobs tough, because what would be a good example? Something more like maybe sickle cell is a better example of you have the genotype and having the phenotype, whereas this is, there are multiple layers to this. It might be good for us to explore a little bit more, Carly. You were going to talk about the exons and just giving us a little bit more information. You provided a great background on the introns being like supporting the exons. We used to call it junk DNA. We no longer do that. I even knew when I was in high school, I was like, this seems weird. How is 90% of our DNA junk? But now we know that it has functions, but that the exons are actually expressed and that's what's turned into proteins. That's probably my level of understanding. And I'm looking forward to learning more from both of you in terms of like applying exons and looking at this with reading exons maps, as we can see here. So take us through what we're looking at here. For those that are watching the video, I do recommend at some point, if you're listening to this in the audio form, at some point going over to YouTube or our website, dnatoday.com, and watching the video. But we're also kind of going to auditorily walk you through it as well if you don't end up watching the video.
So this is a picture of the DMD map. And each of these, I'm sorry, DMD exon map. And each of the blue boxes here is one of the exons. And there are 79 exons, and the different sizes of them correspond with the size of the DNA that's within each of these exons. But the piece that is really important when you're looking at this is what those shapes are on the end of the exons. So for those of you listening, again, going to look at the map is helpful, but they have different shapes. They're kind of chevroned going in, chevron going out, or straight. And in between each of the exons, there is white space. And the white space will be those introns. So if you take the introns out, then all of these pieces come together like a puzzle, and that would be a full protein. The different shapes correspond, though, to the different possible codon letters, so that we think, perhaps without really realizing it, that exons should just end at the third letter of a codon and continue on in the next exon. That, like, exons don't need to do that. There's no reason for them to do that because you just take out the intron and then they would come back together. So if you have an ingoing intron shape, that might end at the first letter of a codon, and then that outgoing chevron shape might be the second and third letter of the codon.
So like a part one, part two, those pieces really need to be together for that amino acid to be coded. Am I getting that right?
Okay. You got that perfect. And so you could imagine then in this picture, I mean, the classic example is missing exon 50. And so 50 starts with a straight line and ends with an ingoing chevron. And 49 ends, of course, with that straight line. And 51 starts with that ingoing chevron.
So it's kind of like an arrow for people that don't know what that is.
It's a chevron.
You're so fancy for us. No, I've just never heard that term, to be honest. You're so fancy for me, Carly. But yeah, it's kind of like an arrow, I would say. So the arrow kind of fits into the other part that is like the cutout part of an arrow. But yes, okay. So the 50 is what's commonly deleted?
It is a common deletion. And so you can see that 51 with that pointed out arrow would not fit into 49 with that straight line. And so if you're missing 50, those pieces no longer fit together like pieces of a puzzle. And what ends up happening then is you get a frame shift and you have a protein that doesn't make any sense to the cell and it gets degraded. And that's when you lose that dystrophin protein.
So that protein, is it like truncated? Am I using that right? Where it basically is like you've got the first 49 exons, the amino acids that go to that. So like that first part of the protein is made and then the rest of it just isn't made. So then it's not going to fold correctly and all that. And like the downstream effects of that, or is it a little different?
John, when you do the biopsies, can you tell that there's part like the beginning part of the proteins there, just not the whole thing, or is the whole thing degraded?
I mean, generally, there are certain deletions that you can have where the remaining protein will remain, but be truncated, as you're saying, Kira. So that can happen. So like if you have a deletion of exons 1 to 5, I mean, you know, you can start in exon 6 and end up with a protein that's just a truncated. It doesn't have the same N-terminus that it normally would. But most of them, when you have a deletion, you end up with a nonsensical protein, and you just end up with nonsense-mediated decay.
So it would just break down, like it wouldn't necessarily be present to say, oh, here's like the mini protein. Like it would just kind of, you know,
exactly.
The body would just break it down or something.
Yeah, if it doesn't have a way of kind of binding to both the N and C terminus in a meaningful way, for the most part, it's going to be degraded.
So that is the out-of-frame mutation, because it changes the frame, the reading frame, versus if, for example, you're missing exon 47, you can see that 46 and 48 both have straight lines. 47 both has straight lines on either side, and 46 and 48 would come back together. And so that would be an in-frame mutation. You're missing a little bit of information, but the reading frame is maintained.
So how does clinical presentation differ on your example of missing 50, that exon is deleted, versus missing 47? Is that like DMD versus Becker?
Thank you. Yes.
Wow. Okay. I feel like I'm in school because
I really
don't know the answers to this. Interesting.
I mean,
okay.
Kira, like that's a
textbook
in general
answer. Yes. For boards. Yes.
Yes. Don was making that point before, that just because you have an in-frame mutation doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have a person that's going to develop Becker's. There are surprises that happen often.
Genetics, it's always more complicated than we thought, is what Laura Hersher always says. She was one of my professors at Sarah Lawrence. But it makes sense to me that if you basically don't have presence of a working protein, you're going to have a more severe form that's going to affect you earlier in life, versus having some kind of protein that doesn't work as well, but it's still there, that's going to happen to you later in life with less severe symptoms. Obviously, that is a very overarching statement, mm-hmm. but that seems to be the case of DMD versus Becker, if I'm getting that right.
Yeah, and it's really, if you really want to drill down into it, there are a lot of differences that we know about and others that we're just understanding. You know, so like if you miss 44-45, that's an in-frame mutation, and it's very, very mild, so that it hardly ever even shows up. So those people really look quite good. If you're missing 45-46, that's also in frame. Those people have a more classic form of Becker, but they have very severe cardiac involvement as a general rule, so that they would get more heart disease before they got more skeletal muscle disease. So there are these differences that indicate that there are specific features of the protein beyond just whether or not the protein exists or doesn't exist.
So I imagine, as like I work in prenatal, so this doesn't come up for me as often, but you know, if I was someone that was working in pediatrics with a kid that maybe their brother is affected, and this is another boy, that looking at maybe doing their testing to say, okay, well, are they going to be affected, and looking at their results of looking at which exons are deleted can give us a little bit of a preview of what that can look like. Is that something that you guys recommend for genetic counselors, to be looking at this exon map to say, oh, let me see like how that works? Is it like the puzzle pieces would go together, or they wouldn't fit in terms of those symptoms? I mean, obviously they also want to be talking to someone that knows this, but just in terms of educating themselves or students that are looking to just be learning this and taking examples of cases online.
I think it's a good start, but I think that the issue is that each person's individual, and you may make a good guess as to what's going to happen in that particular deletion. Finding other cases of people who have the same deletion is also quite useful, but you can't always make predictions just based on the reading frame rule.
That makes sense. You don't want to just rely on that by itself. And then, Carly, in terms of, you know, being a genetic counselor and meeting with patients that are in this situation or parents of children, how does, you know, looking at this exon skipping, how does this influence what you talk about with families? Are you going to the level of detail that we've talked about so far in this episode? Are you scaling it back? Or, you know, like I'm kind of thinking, you're someone that you know, is really looking at the details of this. And I imagine you're really going to want to give the patient as much information as they can handle, I guess, in the moment.
I think that it doesn't need to be necessarily an in-the-moment thing. Like, I'm there for long-term support. So, your point about having the amount of information needed at the moment is well taken. But I think that when people go home with a diagnosis of Duchenne, they are immediately looking online for things, and they're going to see exons. They're going to see all these therapy options. And so it is a service to them to be able to go into that knowing a little bit about it and knowing what's available to them and what the result says.
Yeah, I think that's very helpful. And especially when you're giving someone a diagnosis, the diagnosis is not going to change, especially if we have genetics to be backing up that clinical diagnosis. And knowing that they can come back to you to say, okay, like, I've processed this information. Now I want more of the details. And just kind of knowing as a genetic counselor to, you know, read the room and see where is a patient at right now. If you're giving a DMD diagnosis, I don't think in that session and that, you know, however long that takes, you're going to start going into exon skipping, as you alluded to there, Carly. Maybe?
I mean, so I don't go into exon skipping much in general. I let my docs take care of that. But I do bring up, if somebody is found to have a exon that's amenable to exon skipping therapy, then I'll tell them, you know, this sucks that you have, that your kid has this deletion, but you happen to have one that's treatable. So let's talk about it.
Yeah. So actually, let's talk about it on the show here. So in terms of treating patients today, I mean, how does this differ? You know, we'll step back from exons for a moment. How are patients treated today in general? And how does this differ in terms of just the last few years? Because we've seen a lot of changes in treatments and in really a good side of things. I mean, we've seen a lot in terms of like SMA being another example of a muscular disorder where we have a really amazing drug from what I've heard from patient advocates and other genetic experts. So, you know, how are patients treated today? Dr. Day, I don't know if you want to start just sharing a little bit about what you talk about with patients.
Well, as I said, we've known about Duchenne for more than 150 years. So there's a lot of kind of built up clinical wisdom about how best to care for patients. And, you know, we work hard with physical and occupational therapists and orthopedic surgeons and pulmonologists to keep boys functioning as well as possible. So that's still an important part of all management of Duchenne. That's, yeah, we're building on that. Probably about 30 years ago, we started using anti-inflammatory drugs, or at least prednisone steroids, more commonly. So that's another part of it. We think it's acting as an anti-inflammatory, as a secondary feature of the muscular dystrophy. And so most of the treatments that we're talking about now are added on top of that. So those are the key elements that provides the foundation. And then you're right, the exciting stuff has come in the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, it was in the fall of 2016, I remember it well, when the first exon skipping drug got approved. And I was a big advocate of it. I continue to be a big advocate for it. I think it's a very, very exciting form of treatment, even though the effects are more modest than we would hope for. You know, I think it shows us that we're on the track to being able to develop really meaningful, substantially effective treatments with that technology. And the good news is that there are even more effective means of exon skipping coming up. But maybe we should talk about what we mean by exon skipping, to keep everybody engaged here. So I don't know, Carly, do you want to go through exon skipping, or
let's go back to the exon map? I'll do a brief thing here, and then if you wanted to add on. But going back to the map, I had mentioned that exon 50 is a very common cause of Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and the first exon skipping therapy was made to skip exon 51. And so the idea is that, by skipping exon 51, it actually can help up to 13% of boys that have Duchenne. About 13% will have a deletion already in their DNA that if you skip 51, all of a sudden, it brings things back into frame. So if you don't have 50 and you skip 51, then this edge here of 49 was a straight edge, and now 52 is a straight edge. And so the reading frame comes back together.
That those puzzle pieces fit by taking out like two of them, kind of thing.
Wow. Taking out an additional one.
Mm-hmm. And so that's, so that's how that drug works, of just being able to skip it or like silence it. And so it just moves along. And then, so do we see normal proteins of DMD proteins in people that are taking that drug?
We wouldn't see a normal protein, because they're going to be missing, they're already missing exon 50. Now they're going to be missing two exons, 50 and 51. But fortunately, 49 to 52 is an in-frame deletion, if you happen to have a deletion involving those two, and skipping exon 51 in addition to having an exon 50 deletion puts you back in frame. So you do get a protein out of it. I mean, what it's doing is it's sticking to the 5' end of exon 51 and basically blocking that splice acceptor site, so that when the spliceosome comes along, the next place that it can see to splice in is now exon 52. It can't see the exon 51 because there's an antisense that is stuck on there and blocked recognition of that as a splice acceptor site. And so it's a really, really tremendously exciting technology. I mean, just when it was shown that this worked, I think, it was shown that it worked in mice, many years before it was approved for people. So we knew that the concept worked, but to actually get it into people and see an increase in the amount of protein.
Wow, that is just amazing how that works. And like an analogy that I've used before, with this is that, if we think of the gene like a highway, and you have like the different exits on the highway, you can think about like almost blocking an exit of, I guess that would be 51 we're talking about blocking. Mm-hmm. So it's like you can't even go there. So it just goes to the next one. If you miss an exit with your GPS, it's going to take you off the next one. So it's great that, I mean, we've even been able to develop something so specific. It's not even just like, oh, it's targeting this gene. It's targeting the spot in a gene. And not even to change anything like CRISPR, of like replacing a letter or something. It's basically saying, oh, no, skip to the next part. Just go ahead a little bit, fast forward. I'm just amazed constantly on the show of how far we've come, especially Dr. Day. I mean, you said like the past 5-6 years or so, and we've kind of alluded to it, but it to confirm, depending on someone's genetic diagnosis, but also clinical symptoms, that can impact what medication they're getting and probably the dosage. I'm kind of going out on a limb there. But is that part of what you're looking at? I guess, Dr. Day, I'll have you answer this, of like, is that influencing what medications you're prescribing and seeing what's going to work the best for that individual?
Oh, 100%. I mean, most, as Carly was saying, it's unfortunately only a minority that are treatable with an exon 51 skipper. But, fortunately, we have other exons for which we have commercial treatments now, 45 and 53. And that covers a significantly larger, percentage, but still the minority of boys are amenable, have mutations that are amenable to this type of treatment. But as we get our technology improved and we really can do this much, much more efficiently, I fully expect that we're going to have many more compounds like this that will skip different exons. And if you think about it, some mutations would require or being able to skip two exons in order to put back in frame. And if we have an efficient means of doing that, then there's no reason why we couldn't do it. If we have an inefficient way, then the likelihood that you're going to end up with an in-frame product out of that is low. But these things are coming. There's no doubt in my mind that we'll see these forms of antisense treatments developed for many more boys with Duchenne in the future.
Yeah, I've really seen this term, like I don't even remember seeing the term antisense years ago. it's probably also because I'm not really directly in the field of like prescribing and all of that. But at the same time, like I've seen it so much in the past couple of years. And I'm like, that kind of just goes to show you, like, we, for people that listen to this podcast all the time, like you guys have heard guests bring this up a lot more in the last couple of years than they did 10 years ago. I don't think I even knew of it 10 years ago. I mean, the technology may have been budding or around, but it was not nearly what it is today.
It's been around for decades. I mean, people have been trying to get this to work since the 80s. If not before. And but it was hard. It really took a lot of technological improvements in order to get it into muscle sufficiently to get a clinical benefit out of it.
Yeah, but that's
the technology,
a good point too.
Keeps ramping up, and it's a new era. There's no question about it.
Yeah, kind of looking at how you're administering this drug and what areas of the body it needs to go to. Obviously for DMD, we're focused on muscles, but for other disorders, we're focused on other aspects of the body. And so that might be easier or harder to get to in terms of administering that. Another aspect I was thinking about when it comes to treatment is the difference in disease progression in terms of, you know, treating. I'm kind of thinking it in three different groups. So for kids that are diagnosed prior to symptoms, like in a situation where someone knows DMD maybe is in the family and then there's a risk for a child to inherit this condition, versus people that are diagnosed just as symptoms are beginning, that they're starting to have those signs between 3 and 5 years old, versus patients that have been diagnosed and are now being treated when symptoms have already started progressing. So those kind of being my three groups, before, during, and after, I suppose. So how do we see the treatment effective level differing between this? I mean, obviously, I would think it's going to be much more effective before, but how much more effective? Like how advantageous is it to have that diagnosis prior to symptoms or right as they start?
Yeah, we don't have great trials that really delineate that clearly. I mean, most of the trials have been on boys after they're more clearly affected, so maybe 4 or 5 year old boys at the earliest. There is some experience with treating boys younger, but the data is just not as definitive in that group. My suspicion, my sense, my belief is that it's always better from a medical standpoint to treat as early as possible. But from a psychological and family standpoint, that might not be the case. I mean, currently these drugs are administered intravenously, and you have to have an intravenous infusion once a week. And so to start that in a boy that's not even 2 years old is really quite impactful, and, you know, in other ways. And so you might be making the muscle better, but making the patient's life more complicated. And so this is another reason why, you know, if we can come up with better versions of this, I think it's going to be easier to sell people on the idea of treatment at an earlier age.
Yeah, because it's one thing, like, we can say, oh, well, it's ideal to do this or that, but you also have to think, like, well, how does this impact the family's life? Can they even do this? So I think that's something that, you know, especially younger genetic counselors, you may not think of that at first, like, oh, of course, why wouldn't you do this? But at the same time, it's like, okay, every week, think of how that looks, especially if the family has multiple kids. How expensive is this? Is insurance covering it? All the socioeconomic reasons that go beyond just what is genetically the best setup. So I think, you know, coming from, you know, the physician perspective, mm-hmm. Dr. Day, I think that's really good to remind people listening, and for patient advocates listening, of like, should I do this? Like, kind of having a little bit of information, just like in terms of what that could look like. It's not as easy as taking a pill a day that we see for like other disorders. But this has just been really interesting to me. You guys could tell that I'm really authentically asking these questions that I knew very little about exon map and exon skipping prior to this. So I just want to thank you both so much for coming on and taking the time to explain this to me and my audience. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our audience with before we end the episode?
The broader phenotype of Duchenne, you know, so that it affects heart for sure. And we're not sure that we're having as good an effect in terms of exon skipping in cardiac muscle as we are in skeletal muscle. So I think, again, that's an area where the new generation of treatments is going to be more beneficial. And it does affect the central nervous system. So there's an increased risk of, in Duchenne boys, of either having cognitive impairment or behavioral challenges. And right now we're not dealing with that. So it's there are other elements, even as we bring the skeletal muscle form of the disease or portion of the disease under control, we have to keep our eyes on the rest of the disease.
It certainly is a complicated disorder. It is not as straightforward. It only affects this because, you know, once we talk about one aspect, like, you know, you're bringing up with like cardiac issues, and then I didn't know about this central nervous system issues too, going with that. It's like the more we research, and even of a condition that we've known about for over 100 years, like, we're still learning more. So I think that's, I guess, an encouraging aspect that we are developing these new treatments. We are learning much more about the condition, and I think we always will be. I don't think we'll ever get to a point where, like, we know everything about a condition.
Everything we've talked about today is really kind of like the majority groups of the Duchenne. So this applies to anybody who has only a single X chromosome. So that might also be females who have Turner's syndrome. That might also be intersex folk. So it is wider than just the boys or men that we're referring to today. There are also other types of mutations that can happen. It's not just these deletions. There can also be duplications. There can also be nonsense mutations and missense mutations, and those were not brought up today. I think there's still hope for nonsense read-through therapies for the future. So there are also other therapies that might happen that might help people who have Duchenne for other causes.
Something I think about from the prenatal perspective is, like, how I come across DMD is when I'm doing carrier screening on people that are looking to become pregnant or are already pregnant, which is usually more the situation in the U.S., just with how our healthcare system is set up. Like, you're meeting with someone once you're already pregnant. And that, you know, DMD will come up for those patients if they're identified as a carrier, which isn't everybody, because only a certain section of people that are diagnosed with DMD have a parent that is actually a carrier of DMD, and that people are a carrier of DMD can only be assigned female at birth or have two X chromosomes. But that's something that, you know, I was thinking about going into this. What was the breakdown? I don't remember, of how many cases are de novo or random where we don't see the carrier aspect.
Yeah, so the numbers break down in general. About a third of boys that have DMD have a brand new mutation. A third of them, the mother is found to be a carrier, and a third of them, the mother has inherited it herself.
Oh, that's a good distinction to make. You can tell I haven't had a DMD case in a while. Yeah, so thank you for clarifying that. Helpful to know that just because you've done carrier screening and it's come back that we haven't found anything, it doesn't rule out the chance of having a child with DMD. But thank you both so much for sharing all of this. I have learned a tremendous amount, probably more than I have on episodes this year, certainly. So thank you both so much for just being so eloquent in the way you explain things and entertaining my curveball questions as well.
Thanks so much, Kara, for having us, fun. Kara.
Thanks for watching DNA Today. To access all of our episodes, head over to dnatoday.com. We also have a lot of bonus content on there that you can enjoy. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, guest pitches, you name it, send them in to info@dnatoday.com. We'd also really appreciate if you could take a moment to rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to the show. It really helps more nerds like yourself find the show. Also, if you like giveaways and other ways to connect with us, I recommend following us on social. We're at DNA Today Podcast. We also have a Patreon if you want to be the most level involved in the show. That's also at DNA Today Podcast. Thank you so much for listening and watching. Join us next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics. We're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.